Welcome back to Fire Interview, the Storyteller Podcast. I'm your host, Brendan Trainer. Today we have for you Rain Gray. Rain Gray talks about his time in the Marines and then transitioning into the fire service and his highly decorated career, where he was just promoted from battalion chief to a deputy chief with the Phoenix Fire Department. He also talks about his passion for fitness. He's a two-time Ironman competitor, and at 50 years old, he's still competing. He's training right now. He's going to try to do 100 miles on his mountain bike in 24 hours, no sleep, at the Old Pueblo race. He's got an amazing story to tell. I really think you're going to enjoy him. Welcome, Deputy Chief Rain Gray. As always, Fire Interview, the Storyteller Podcast, is brought to you by the book, Fire Interview, the Storyteller Method. If you're preparing for a recruit firefighter interview, make sure you get a copy of the book at fire-interview.com, along with all of our podcast merchandise. Get yourself a hat, get yourself a t-shirt. Make sure you get a copy of that book to prepare for your interview. We're also brought to you by publicsafetyanswers.com. PublicSafetyAnswers.com is a testing company that can bring your fire department or your fire district's testing to the 21st century. Make sure you reach out to them if you're looking for a testing company. Right now, they have applications open for the Greater Flagstaff region. That's three cities testing together: the City of Flagstaff, Summit, and Highlands, all testing together right now for recruit firefighters. That process closes on January 22nd, so make sure you go get your applications in. Daisy Mountain Fire and Medical is also hiring right now for EMT and paramedic positions for their ambulance. That process closes on January 16th, so you only have a couple more days. Go get your applications in for Daisy Mountain Fire and Medical. All of the links for applications for these fire departments are found, as usual, on our Instagram at fire_interview. Just click the link in the bio, or you can go to our website, fire-interview.com. Without further ado, Rain Gray. Chief, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here with you.
Yeah, last time we were on headset together, I think our fire interview Instagram was like 5 days old. I had just written the book, and you were the second podcast we went on a little podcast tour.
Nice. Well, we need to bring you back now that so you're more experienced. Yeah.
I might actually have something worth saying this
right.
time.
No, that episode was fantastic. And I will tell you, the reason I had you on the podcast is because it's so important to talk about how you approach an interview. You don't just sign up for it and show up on game day. You actually have to do some preparation. So the fact that you put together a model that helps guys understand how to prepare is super important.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a great time on your podcast. So, for the people that don't know you, let's just give us a little bit of background. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Vancouver, British Columbia, and spent a bunch of years there. We moved to Toronto, Ontario, and I lived for a few years there. Started high school, freshman year in Central High in Toronto, Ontario, and then moved back to Vancouver, did my sophomore year there. And then my mom decided that my dad were originally from Los Angeles, California. So after their divorce, she decided she wanted to go back home. So we moved back to Los Angeles. So I finished my high school years in Calabasas, California.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what did you do after high school?
So after high school, went right out of high school into the Marine Corps. And
what drove that decision?
Oh, you want to get into that now, huh? Okay. So I'll tell you all about that. Coming out of high school, honestly, I was a pretty crummy student all through elementary, and not because I, from my assessment, not because I'm not a smart guy, but because I just didn't, was not a good student. I didn't have good skills, as study skills, etc. So honestly, I'm looking around myself, and all the people around me are going to college, and they have plans, and I'm like, I don't have any plans. I don't know what I'm going to do. Yeah. And then one day, this guy in his dress blues comes strutting across the campus, and me and my homeboys are sitting at the lunch bench eating our lunch, and he waltzes up, and he's like, "What do you guys got going on?" And I'm like, "I don't know, ham sandwich." He's like, no, big picture, my friend. What are we doing after high school?" And I'm like, "Oh." Everyone else is like, "Oh, I'm going on a mission, or I'm going to go to college at this university. I was accepted to, Purdue already." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, these guys all have plans. I have nothing." And so I'm like, "Well, I don't know. What do you got to offer?" Mm-hmm. He's like, follow me, son.
And that was it.
And that was it. So that was, yeah. it was sort of a lack of opportunity. And then it presented in, you know, here's an opportunity. And so I saw a lot of value in going off and doing something that was going to shape and change my life and provide me with some potential benefits, you know, a GI Bill, et cetera.
Yeah.
Right. And that was it. And it was just an opportunity to do something.
Yeah. I was in a similar boat with, again, the same thing. Like, I don't think that I'm not a smart person, but I was not smart at schoolwork in high school, you know, just a very average student. And so I joke now when I go teach like trauma management and stuff for doctors, I always open with, yeah, I was going to be a doctor too, but they didn't have that at Mesa Community College. And, read it like a third grade level. So I want to email my old English teacher and be like, first of all, I'm not in prison like you thought. And, turns out I'm now a best-selling author. So who's the dummy now?
Right.
But yeah, same thing. So you go into the Marines, you're there for 4 years.
I did 4 years in the Marine Corps. I was, my MOS was 1811 and I transitioned to 1812, which is armor. So I was in M60 tanks when I first went in, got trained, and then we transitioned in the M1 Abram, which is a, gosh, night and day difference in these apparatus. I was right there in this transition period. I went in September of 90 and made it into my MOS school when the ground war was underway in Desert Storm. And so as we were going through our training program, they're like, hey, you guys are going into combat. You have got to have your ass wired tight so that you know what you're doing. So we were under a lot of pressure to perform and to study, and it was game on. And as we were graduating from tank school, they hand us our packets. Hey, here's orders. You are going to meet your unit. You're going to 1st Tank Battalion. They are deployed in theater. And the 100-hour war came and went, and all of a sudden the war was over just like that. And they're like, okay, so go report to Camp Pendleton. And we spent the next 6 months making beds and you know, sweeping dust bunnies out underneath racks so that when the guys got back, they were ready to go. So I spent the next, you know, couple years of my life training, and we got relocated from Camp Pendleton to 29 Palms. So if any of you are aware, it is a luxurious desert paradise. In the Mojave Desert, just outside of Palm Springs. It's glorious. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the military is very similar to the fire service in that, you know, every day is not like the TV show Chicago Fire, where you're dangling out of helicopters with a handful of babies you just saved. It's mostly cleaning and training.
Yeah, I can't. The number of hours I spent scrubbing carbon off of my weapon systems was, you know, I can't even begin to count the number of hours. Right? It's a lot of.
It's my dog's going crazy. That means my kids are home.
Do you want to wait for them to stop, or you want to just plow on?
We just plow on. Cool. I apologize about my dogs.
So to your point, The thing about being, you know, particularly the time that I was in, you know, to peacetime military, it's all about preparation. It's planning and preparing, getting equipment ready, getting personnel ready. You do, they had stopped floating tanks. So the Marine Corps does these, forward positioned units, MEUs, they call them. And those, they used to float tanks and they float infantry and they sit out in the, ocean waiting for conflicts to happen. And they stopped those floating. And as a result, I went kind of nowhere while I was in the Marine Corps. I went to some training schools and did some really cool stuff, but, didn't deploy.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, we were joking before we started about the, again, another similarity between the military and the fire department is you're not always paid for what you're doing. You're like, man, we're paying these guys to just train and clean. And if you're a fireman, a lot of time you're getting paid to sleep or eat or whatever. And we talked about, you're really paid for what you're capable of doing. Because every day is not going to be this blazing fire where you're asked to really step up to the plate, but you have to be prepared. That's why we spend so much time training. And that's really what that local fire station in your neighborhood, if it doesn't seem like they're that busy, you're paying them for what they're capable of doing. And one day, if you have to make that call, hopefully that team is dialed in.
Absolutely. And, you know, interestingly, that preparation, what they're capable of doing and what they're prepared to do, They're getting paid to do that preparation, right? So we don't come to work and just hope that nothing happens and have this trunk full of tools and trunk full of skill sets that are sitting waiting to be deployed. We're actually honing the edge on those tools on a regular basis. And I mean that kind of metaphorically, right? Because your skill set as a medic with the knowledge and stuff that you, the knowledge, skills, and abilities that you have inside your brain have to be razor sharp as well. So how do you maintain that knowledge? You know, you go to medic school, they crack open your skull, push a bunch of stuff in. Well, how do you maintain that?
Yeah.
It requires CE and continuation training, et cetera. It requires regular revisiting to maintain currency of your skills. And on the EMS side, we do this a lot because we're getting new policies and meds are changing and evolving and medicine is, there's lots of research, et cetera, and gathering data. And so medicine evolves and changes on a regular basis. Well, on the fire side of the house, things are changing and evolving as well. So like we have an influx in the last few years of mid-rise complexes. Those require a little bit different tactic because they're laid out in a different way. They've got different fire code, et cetera, that inform the way they're built. And so as a result, the threat and the behavior, the way the fire is going to behave inside those occupancies is totally different, right? In the way the locations of standpipes, the access issues, et cetera, the way they shoehorn them into all kinds of odd shaped lots.
Whatever's cheapest, right?
Yeah, right. They'll find these strange, they find, hey, there's a little strip of land that's inside, you know, this little neighborhood, and they build a mid-rise in there.
Yeah.
And so that so what do? We have to adjust and change our approach to these events. And so as we're doing that, we come to work every day. I like to think that, oh, yeah, you get some downtime to sit in a strato. And you will get some downtime. But a large portion of your day needs to be spent on your skill set and actively developing who and what you're capable of doing for the community.
Yeah. We've skipped forward probably in time to talking about firefighting, but did you go straight into Phoenix Fire out of the Marines, or how did you even decide you wanted to become a firefighter?
Well, that's actually a funny story. So I came out of the Marine Corps and I had already had my EMT. So when I was in the Marine Corps, I got stationed in 29 Palms. So if anybody knows that area, it is right next to Joshua Tree National Park. And Joshua Tree National Park is a mecca for rock climbing. And I was a brand new novice climber, had just started climbing and found myself dropped into this mecca. So my climbing skills and experience just shot through the roof because that's all I did on my days off. I was go out to the park and climb. So I said, you know what would be really cool? I would love to do search and rescue. And so I volunteered with the National Park Service. And they said, yeah, listen, we don't just need a bunch of rock climbers. We need people who actually have a skill set.
Yeah.
So go get your EMT and then come back. So I went and got my EMT. And now I was part of the National Park Service's search and rescue team. And by that, I mean, I got to go to some training exercises. And that was really about it. But when I got out of the Marine Corps, I had my EMT in hand. I'm like, man, I would love to go search and rescue as a career. It's not really a viable option, but I had that in the back of my mind. And so I started going to school. I'm going to school at ASU and the local community college and catching classes and trying to, you know, go to school. It's what you do, right? And I'm working at REI because all I really knew was about rock climbing. I had no other skills apart from weapon systems, et cetera, which were not directly applicable to much of anything. Mm-hmm. And as I'm working there, I have a few friends that are that end up on the job. One of which was working with me. He was Sun Lakes firefighter. A shout out to Brent, if he's listening. And he took me on my first ride along. And for those of you who are unaware, that is not a very busy little part of the town. It's quite quiet. It's a bedroom community. Very quiet. So I show up there for my ride along with my box of donuts and hi guys. And 30 seconds into my visit, they pop a 3-in-1 house fire. And so they're at shift change, a scramble happens, and yeah, we end up with a couple guys on the truck and off we go. And there's this wicked house fire. And I'm like, dude, this is the best. Unbelievable.
Every day this.
Yeah. I can't even imagine. I'm like, wow, that was super cool. And, anyways, they gave me a dose of reality, but I didn't believe it cause I saw what I saw.
Yeah.
And, anyways, not too much longer after that, one of my good friends gets hired with Tempe Fire. And she, I call her up and I said, hey, is this a real job? Tell me more about this job. And she starts telling me about the benefits and kind of the process and whatever. And I spent the next 6 months every day making phone calls, because back in the day you had to call the hotline and to see if there was any job openings.
Yeah.
And predating the, you know, kind of the internet access for all this stuff. So I start making, I'm faking phone calls every day, trying to find out who's hiring. And that was it. And then I got a couple of tests and I went and took, I remember I took my very first written test and failed it because I did not know what I was getting into at all. And I just made my way around the horn, and I eventually landed a position with Sun City West Fire, and worked out there for about 3.5 years, and then came over to the dark side, to Phoenix.
Big red.
And I've been there ever since.
Do you still climb now?
No, I do not. When we had kids, we moved out to Arizona. Climbing in Arizona is a little bit different because it's very seasonal, mm-hmm. and you have to kind of get out of the valley to go climb real rock. Mm-hmm. And I was not much into climbing in the gyms and stuff like that. So yeah. My climbing took a turn, and then we had kiddos, and it just became less important. And I started doing other things that were something I could do solo. So I know we had talked about Ironman a little bit and some other stuff like that. So I still wanted to do some really cool stuff that was that would push me a little bit. But I needed to do it alone.
Did you watch Free Solo?
I have seen that movie, yes.
Did you watch Don Wall?
Yes. Did you? All those things. I watch it all.
Did you watch The Alpinist? That one just came out.
I have not seen that one yet.
Okay, that's a good one.
Is it good?
It's so
Is that the one where the guy does like 7 of the highest peaks in 6 months or something like that?
That's a different one.
Okay.
The Alpinist, they interview the guy from Free Solo on there, who I thought was like the most insane guy ever.
We're talking about Honnold, right?
I can't remember his
Alex
name.
Alex Honnold?
The guy that Free Soloed El Cap. Mm-hmm. And we'll put it this way. When he's describing the guy, the main character in The Alpinist, who I also can't remember his name, he goes, "That dude is crazy." The guy that's saying that is the Free Solo guy. And you're like, right. Well, how freaking crazy is The Alpinist guy? So,
So you know what's interesting about
that
is Alex Honnold, who is the one who Free Soloed El Cap, is super. We see the end result, which is him free soloing this multiple thousands of feet up on some of the most extreme.
I think it's over 3,000 feet, right?
It's something like that. It's about 2,500 or 3,000, and it's the grading of it is incredibly high as well. So the skill it takes to climb it, just in general, is incredibly high. And then on top of that, he's doing it free solo, so no ropes, no nothing, right? So. The interesting thing, though, is that the process to get you there is incredibly intricate. He climbed every section of that rock with ropes many, many, many times before he soloed it. So there's a lesson in that, right? So by the time he free soloed it, he had rehearsed every move that he was going to make many times, especially the cruxes, the spots that were incredibly sticky for him, or tricky rather, dangerous.
The karate kick spot.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Where there's a dynamic move, he's thousands of feet up, and he has to do a kind of a jump over to a super razor thin hold. And he rehearsed that again and again and again and again, to the point where he was doing it flawlessly with rope before he ever thought about taking ropes off.
Yeah.
So people go, "Wow, he's so crazy." But, you know,
really, he's just a master of his craft.
Very prepared, right? There's the whole Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours, right, to master something. And that's exactly what that was. These climbers take calculated risks. Yeah. And I think that's important as we're talking about, you know, the fire service, as we're talking about, you know, doing a very risky job, or say, "Hey, I want to become a firefighter." There's some risk in transitioning in your life from whatever it is you're doing now into this next endeavor. And if you're you know, you're putting it out there when you're going into an interview. Well, how do you make that less intimidating?
Yeah.
You prepare, right? People say, "How do you, you know, friends and family are like, how do you run into burning buildings?" I'm like, I don't just run into there not knowing what the hell I'm doing. I have a plan in place, and I have tools, and I have skills that help me mitigate and ameliorate the risk, right? It's calculated risk.
Right.
I know if it's going to flash over, I don't go in there. If it's about to flash, I put water on it and cool it, and then make entry. Like, there's a way to do this job.
Right.
And if you don't, the things that you don't know are what create risk for you, because you don't know. And so you learn, like, there's risk in everything that we do. How do you manage it? You know? When my wife asked me, "Hey, how does this outfit look?" There's risk, right? I got to be thoughtful about how I'm going to approach that, right? Like, everything we do in life has an element of risk, and we are always managing some form of risk in everything that we do. The question is And I think that this is a question I ask myself now in my current roles and responsibilities is, do I have time to make a decision? Do I have discretionary time? If I'm on a fire incident, my discretionary time goes down very rapidly. I've got to move quickly and I'm acting on limited information. If I have an issue, a broader political issue or it's a policy issue or something like that, I have a little bit of time, right? And now I'm going to thoughtfully work through the situation, understand all the variables, mm-hmm. work through the variables and the consequences, blah, 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 and then make a calculated decision about that. So it's funny. So going back to the original point, any risky endeavor requires consideration about whether or not we have time. Do you have discretionary time or not, et cetera. And when you look at the folks who are doing incredibly risky behaviors, most of the time, when we look at Alex Honnold, the people who are successful and don't die are very well calculated in their efforts.
Oh yeah. It took him, if you guys haven't seen this documentary, basically it's called Free Solo, and there's another one called Don Wall, and you should watch both of those and then watch The Alpinist if you have an extra 6 hours, you know. But yeah, he spends like 2 years planning the route and just looking at it from the bottom with a telescope. And it's like that saying, practice does not make perfect, practice makes permanent. So if you're doing your practice incorrectly, right, you're doing it lazy. And I see that with my weightlifting background. You see someone who their clean and jerk or their snatch is kind of garbage and they're doing it lazy. But they're like, yeah, but I got Malcolm Gladwell, right? I got to do 10,000 hours of this. Well, doing it for 10,000 hours the wrong way doesn't make it perfect.
You're just deepening permanent. Those grooves.
Right.
You're reinforcing bad behaviors.
Yeah, so let's do it the right way. Yeah. So when you do the karate kick 3,000 feet in the air, you don't fall.
Right. Yeah, it's precision.
So do you remember your first fire? How long were you on Phoenix Fire when you got your first fire? Oh, let's back up for a second.
So my very first fire.
Do you remember your interview?
Which one?
For Phoenix.
I do, actually. Well, I remember parts of it. There was a couple things that I leaned on as experiences. And so, yeah, there's parts of my interview that I absolutely remember. And I've talked so many times to folks who are coming in about how to prepare for an interview and what to talk about and how to pull out the things that are important from your life, the life lessons, and how do you apply those to the interview. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I have a couple, you know, anecdotes, if you will, that I always lean on, as these were things that are transformative in my life and shape who I am and what I bring to the table. So, yeah, So yes, I do remember a couple of things I talked about.
There's my dog's going crazy again. I apologize. So tell us about your first fire. How long were you on when the first one kicked out? Because the New York guys will make fun of you if it's not on the first day.
Well, it was definitely not on the first day. So yeah, start making fun.
Yeah, mine wasn't the first day either.
No, so I started my career in Sun City West, which is a bedroom community. It's a senior community, so a lot of older folks there, and a little bit quieter neck of the woods, if you will. And the very first, I'm trying to remember now the exact timing. I'm going to screw this up. I don't remember now. I'm getting old. It was Christmas Eve, that much I know. And we were second due truck, and we pull in. It was outside of our community, so we were responding as kind of an automatic aid into our neighboring community, and we were second due. And we come rolling up, and the house is blowing stem to stern in the front room. It's just fire floor to ceiling from, and I can see it from the truck. Step off the truck. They're like, hey, our assignment is to go help the first in company. I'm like, perfect. So I bottle up, run in, and I'm standing in the front yard looking at this kid who's putting his gloves on. He's got the hose line between his knees, charged, ready to go. And I'm standing there waiting for him to make his move. And I look at him and I realize he doesn't have his helmet on. His hoodie, he's got his mask on it. He's clicked in, his hood's on, no helmet. And I look at him and I say, oh, hey. And I point to his head and I go, no helmet. And he drops the nozzle, reaches up to his head and goes, oh gosh. And he takes off running. So now here I am standing by myself with this nozzle.
Pick it up.
My backseat partner comes running up. He goes, let's go. So I grab the nozzle and I without a whole lot of thought, and I, this is not probably the most, the smartest way to approach this. I just barrel in to the front door of this place, get about 6 feet in, nozzles open, I'm throwing water all over the place. My feet hook up on something and I go down like a sack of potatoes, boom, right on the ground. Jump back up, and I'm like, hope nobody saw that or realized what happened there. Continue putting out the fire. And once we get fire control, go back in the living room, the smoke begins to lift. And sitting in the living room floor was the bell housing of a transmission. And I was like, what the hell is that doing in the living room? And I still don't have an answer for why that was there, but it just began to understand, like, hey, people do very strange things in their homes, and you are going to find all kinds of weird presentations when you walk into someone's house. Mm-hmm. The floor plans are weird. People put furniture in strange places that was not intuitive. They put car parts in the living room. Like, you just don't know what you're going to get. So that was my very first fire. And it had so many fun little pieces of it. Yeah, I'll never forget that.
Yeah, that's awesome. What made you decide to switch over to Phoenix? Was it that deep-rooted that you still wanted to do technical rescue?
You know, that's a good point. I think that once I got in the fire service, I realized that, you know, I was becoming a paramedic, and I still had this, I still was rock climbing at that point, still wanted to do the outdoors type stuff, and realizing that I was a little bit ignorant going into the fire service about what different jurisdictions did and what they had available to them, resource-wise, and how that all worked, how it all knitted into the big system. And so, you know, my eyes were made open once I got in there, and I realized, I'm not going to ever see, and this is going to sound really horrible, but I'm never going to see a PEDS call.
Yeah. Working in that community.
Yeah. And I wanted to experience the full depth and breadth of what this job offers. And so I may or may not ever run a hazmat call. I may or may not ever run a PEDS call. I may not ever run any real trauma.
Yeah.
You know, and now 24 years later, I've done all that, and some of those calls I wish I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
And you know, regret, careful what you ask for, I guess. So yeah, that was what drove me to kind of continue to change. Is I wanted a little bit more than what was available to me in that organization. The beauty of this is, though, is that there's guys that I came on the job with who are still working out there, and you have to make a decision for yourself. So many guys say, oh, I need to go to the big. I need to go to the bigs where they run all these calls. They're super busy and they do all this. Well, you have to make a decision for who you are and what you want in your life.
Yeah.
It is not the right decision for everybody.
Yeah.
And so just because it appears cool, you know, mm-hmm. really consider what a jurisdiction has, what they do, what their mission is, how they serve the community. Because at the end of the day, that's the most important thing is that they are serving in the community. And so you just have to determine what you want to do. Where do you yeah. want to find yourself serving? And then, you know, is that in a bedroom community or is it in the big city? And is that diversity important to you?
Yeah.
You know, you got to answer that question before you get there.
And I think when it comes to moving up to a bigger department, and this is not going to be a true statement for every department, right? For sure, if you're on the East Coast, but over here on the West Coast and specifically in the Valley, not including some of the outlying departments, but here in the Valley, the big cities, and saying, well, I want to jump over to Phoenix because I want to fight more fire. Well, you will, right? You will for sure. But what I tell guys is it's pretty much the same ratio of mm-hmm. calls. And what I mean by that is you may get one good working house fire for every 50 EMS calls. And of those 50 EMS calls, a lot of them are fall injuries or whatever. They're not that exciting. Well, the ratio is no different necessarily in a smaller city like wherever you worked before, Sun Lakes, right?
Sun City West.
Sun City West.
Yeah.
So they're probably also a house fire every 50 calls. The difference is it may take them a month to get 50 calls, where some Phoenix stations, it takes 2 days.
Right.
Or one day if you're in Maryville, right?
Right.
So it's like, man, those guys fight fire every day. It's like, yeah, but they also run 30 EMS calls a day too.
Right.
So it's a give and take. Now, if you really want to just fight fire, you just want to fight your face off all day, then go to Detroit and you'll just fight back to back fire.
Right. Right. Yeah. But so it's interesting as you look at cities like Detroit who have a very different promotional process, right? So like there's interesting things that you get from these different places. So, for example, I met a cat from Detroit. It is straight seniority. So if you want to become an officer, just put your time in.
Ah, that's very interesting.
Very different.
Yeah.
Right. So you're just all sitting around waiting for someone to die or retire.
Cause the other thing about that is I know, seniority and experience is very important. It's not something that you can teach. It's not replaceable. But that being said, I also know some people that have a lot of seniorities that I don't want making critical decisions.
Yeah. My assessment of not ever worked in this dynamic is, but if you look at human behavior, people who have it coming to them just automatically have no incentive to perform, have no incentive to grow and learn, right?
You're next up.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going to get mine. I just got to wait.
Yeah.
Gotta wait for Joe, gotta wait
for
Sally.
That's a good point, too. I didn't think about that. You just know you're gonna get it when it's your turn versus having to go earn it.
Right. Yeah. So there's something to be said for the organizational dynamic, that the paradigm that causes you to have to put in work, right?
So when you talk about the difference in the structure in Detroit, I know that you just got promoted to deputy chief in Phoenix. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to explain for the people that don't live here in Arizona? Last time we talked, you were a battalion chief.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between a battalion chief and a deputy chief?
So it really has to do with organizational responsibility and position and function. So from an operations perspective, a battalion chief is kind of the direct supervisor over the company officers and the stations. And the deputy chiefs who are in operations are over either a district, kind of an administrative district manager, or you have, or they're the shift commander and they are managing operations for the whole shift each day. Now there's the administrative side of that is you have the, partner of the battalion chief would be the division chief. So it's just the same level in the organization, but they're the administrative counterpart.
Right.
They're managing projects and programs and things like that. And the deputy is usually a section head. So you're managing budgets and procurement and division chiefs and you're taking the executive staff's visions and you're implementing them and putting them into play. So you're doing all the structural stuff that has to happen behind the scenes to make these things come to life.
What are you the deputy chief over right now?
So my current assignment is the Phoenix Fire Department's Regional Dispatch Center.
Okay.
The PFDRDC, if you will.
I'm familiar with it.
I know you are. So I was in that assignment out of class. As a division chief assigned managing that section, and now I've got promoted. I'm still there.
Awesome.
So for the foreseeable future.
And if I, correct me if I'm wrong, they're hiring right now, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that.
I don't know when you're going to post this, but that hiring might be closed. But we try hiring on a pretty regular basis because we need dispatchers, right?
Yeah.
We always need folks. So we're training on a regular basis and we're hiring and pushing people through. It takes about 6 months to become a dispatcher. Mm-hmm. It is not as easy as you might think on the surface. It's a very challenging job. A lot of details, a lot of knowledge that has to be gathered in order to be able to execute as a dispatcher. And you got to be able to process information and listen and speak all at the same time.
Type fast.
Got to type fast, yeah.
We talked about this on your podcast, but we haven't talked about it on mine, so I'll talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
I used to work in Phoenix Dispatch, Phoenix Fire Alarm, for, I think, 2 or 3 years. I can't remember now because this was over 10 years ago. I stayed there part-time for a little bit. But I had worked on the private ambo for like 4 years. I was trying to become a firefighter. And then I can't remember why I put in for Phoenix Alarm. I think I just really wanted to wear a Phoenix Fire shirt, right? Like, I'll take whatever you guys will give me.
Yeah. And, if I would add, I don't know what was in your head, but I imagine you just want to be connected to the system.
Yeah. I want my boss to be a Phoenix BC or DC, right? And so I get in, I get hired, and you don't realize that, you're about to spend 6 months in the classroom learning tactics and strategies and all these on scene reports. And so the reason I'm telling people that is for all those of you who are listening, who are stuck working on the private ambo and thinking I can't get hired and I can't support my family on this. Phoenix Alarm is really a great opportunity. I wish I would have known about it sooner than I did, because it really prepared me even way down the line when I tested for captain. Well, I had thousands of sets and reps that were live action on headset, repeating back on scenes, helping sometimes clean up on scenes for units, balancing calls, you know, typing in comments, doing all the things that really well-oiled machine, because Phoenix Alarm dispatches for how many cities?
30 jurisdictions.
30 cities. So there's always a fire going on in Phoenix Alarm, right? There might not always be a fire going on in Phoenix, but one of those 30 cities has always got some kind of action going on. So when you're up there, I mean, talk about getting good sets and reps. Is you're just getting paid to be a tactical radio operator and help run these incidents. And one thing I like about Phoenix is your dispatchers have more freedom than I think the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the country, they just say copy back. They're not real good at repeating, and they don't have 6 months of training. It's kind of like they maybe have a few days or a few weeks of training. So they don't have the freedoms that we had, at least when I was up there, to be like, he didn't ask for the balance of working fire, but he told me it was on fire and he's pulling hose, so I'm going to balance it for him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or they give an on-scene report and I repeat it back to him, but I clean it up a little bit. Maybe they didn't say I'm taking Roosevelt Command. Well, I'm going to clean it up for him and make him, I show you as Roosevelt Command. I'm adding little things in to try to clean the whole thing up. So going back to the whole like Don Wall thing, you know, those dispatchers in Phoenix really are a master of their craft. And I remember having dispatchers from Scotland in the UK flying into Phoenix to do a tour to say, what is it? How in the world do you have one dispatch center running 30 cities, some of them major cities like Phoenix, and it runs seamlessly with no borders because we have the automatic aid system. So it doesn't matter what side of the street the call's on. We all run under the same SOPs. We all run under that same alarm room if you're in those 30, and then we have Mesa Alarm. But it's really impressive. So I would highly recommend for people who are trying to get hired, if you're tired of the private ambo thing, which is probably 100% of you, to check out Phoenix Alarm, because you'll get to work. Your boss will be a Phoenix fire chief, and you'll get to run tactical incidents, and it definitely pays better than the private ambo.
That's true.
So I would highly recommend it.
One of the things that you hit on, I think is really important, is the expertise. And we've had conversations about this recently as we try to understand why is the Phoenix Fire's Regional Dispatch Center so unique and so highly qualified to do their job. It's because they are a secondary PSAP, and all they do, which is a public safety access point, right? All they do is fire. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of dispatch centers are joint centers where they receive the 911 calls and they do PD dispatch and they do fire dispatch.
Yeah.
So in our neck of the woods, we're so, we've diversified that. And now you have the PD centers send their calls to us, and then they send the fire and medical calls to us, and then we manage those exclusively.
Yeah.
So we've become very, very good, highly qualified at those events. And of course, because it's regional, everybody plays on pretty much the same playbook, right? We've got slight variances from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but those are usually based on local needs or geography or local construction or what have you, like slight differences. But generally speaking, everybody behaves the same. That's what the beauty of the automatic aid system is.
And it's plain English. Because I can always tell when I'm in a jurisdiction, another jurisdiction, and they have a PD dispatcher, because they're all 10-4-9-63. I don't know what any of that means.
Right. Yeah, we don't do the 10 code thing and all that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just say what you mean. Say, yeah. Copy, no one's injured at the car accident. Don't say 10-4-9-63. I'm not a cop.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
So you're overseeing the dispatch center now. And another big thing in your life that I'm enthralled with is Ironman. Hmm. When did you start deciding that you wanted to do Ironman? Had you done marathons before?
No, I had not. I've never done an open marathon, actually.
So let's start with explaining to people who don't know, what does an Ironman entail?
So an Ironman is a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, followed by a marathon. So it's 26.1 miles on foot. And so I didn't just jump right into those. I came out of the Marine Corps and I was like, okay, what's my next adventure, right? I was really loved running and, as far as physical fitness concerned, really enjoyed being a runner. And that's something I had done my whole life as a young guy. I played soccer and then I played football and ran track in high school. And so running was something I really enjoyed doing. And the Marine Corps helped me run longer and longer distances. So when I got out of the Marine Corps, I'm like, oh, I'm a long distance runner now. Let's leverage that. So I stopped by a running store one day, which actually the store is gone now, but the guy who ran the store was an elite triathlete. And he ran kind of the Olympic distance triathlons, which is like a 1500 meter swim, 40K bike, 10K run. And so that was what you see in the Olympics now, wicked fast. It's like an hour and 20 minutes or maybe even faster nowadays. And I was like, well, I don't know if I can do that, but they had this sprint distance triathlon, which is a really little cute, little short thing. It's over in like 45 minutes. I'm like, oh, I want to try that. Yeah. And so I started running sprint triathlons and, I picked up a $100 bike and just kind of got into it. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. Did that for a year. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to do an Olympic distance triathlon. So I just slowly started expanding my distances. And, of course, looming in the distance in this running store that I frequented, I see on the wall this picture of Mark Allen, who's a famous Ironman triathlete, running down the lava fields in Kona. And I'm like, oh, I want to do that. What's that?
Yeah.
What's that? And a good buddy of mine, who I trained with periodically, had run a double Ironman, which was unfathomable to me at the time, and was doing ultra distance stuff and all this other stuff. And he's like, oh yeah, and I'm like, he's a normal guy. And he did it. And I'm like, oh, normal people can do this stuff. So I set my sights on that and started training longer and longer distances. And this is long before we ever had kids and all this other kind of stuff. So I had all kinds of free time. So the journey just sort of slowly evolved. And as I kept going longer and longer, I was like, oh, I can do this, and began to realize that, these things were not out of my reach. So I signed up for my first Ironman. My first one was in Santa Rosa, California. And it was called the Vine Man. I think that race still exists actually to this day. And that was my first one.
So 2.2 mile swim.
2.4. That 0.2 matters.
It matters. So you swim 2.4 miles, you get out of the water, and then you ride a bike for 112 miles.
Yeah.
Then you get off the bike and run a full 26.1 mile marathon.
Yes.
Do you know what the total mileage is?
No.
You don't have the sticker on your car?
140 something maybe?
What's the point of doing it if you don't put the sticker on your car?
I was too tired to put it on after it was over. I couldn't do it.
How long did you have to train to complete it?
So as I said, I ramped up, right? And I was doing all this training. I gave myself a full year to prepare just for that event, which is interesting because, anything can happen, right?
Yeah.
During the course of that training and you could derail yourself. And, I was young and super resilient. And so, stayed healthy, got all the way there, got all the way out to the race site and started that race and in perfect health. And I will tell you, though, that race was eye-opening for me on so many levels. So the swim goes wonderfully. And it was in the Russian River, which is they call it a green river. So it's a very slow-moving river. So we swam up to a buoy, turn around, swim back down the river. And then we had to do two laps of that. And, you swim up, and you're like, oh, fighting the current. And then you hit the turn buoy, and zoom, you come flying back. It was amazing. So I come out of the water right on time. My objective for myself was 1 hour.
What's the cutoff? Do you remember? Because if you don't do it fast enough, they pull you, right?
Yeah, I do not remember. And I will say this, every race has some different rules.
Yeah.
Depending on the conditions and depending on the course and how many waves of people they're going to ride, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so get out of the water in 1 hour. Yeah,
so in that particular race, we did wave starts. So they had different starting points. They had different waves of people would go. And when I did another Ironman in Tempe Town Lake, and it was a mass start. So 1,500 people.
Everybody go.
Assholes and elbows, just freaking smashing the water. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to get drowned by all these people.
Yeah.
But in the Russian River, it was controllable. I was kind of alone most of the time swimming my own race. And but it was my first time swimming kind of an open body of water, sort of. So it wasn't like a lane line. It was different, right? So it's not like training in a pool, which is where I did most of my training. actually, I shouldn't say most of it. All of my swim training was in a pool. So watching the solid black line as I'm, you know, swimming lap, slip turn, swim right. back, slip turn. So this was different. So I come out of the water right on time, right at like an hour and 1 minute, right where I wanted to be. Peel off my stuff. My wife's right there and we just exchange high fives. And she's like, oh, you looking good. And I take my time. I eat a banana. I put on my bike shorts and jump on my bike and off I go. And
I'm feeling like a changing room for you.
No, there's just a big, huge, wide area.
Yeah.
I did keep my, I had like
a Speedo or something.
Yeah. Like an undersuit. That was a cycling undersuit, but I was not sure I wanted to wear that thing for the full 112. Right. So I put a bike saddle with a big old fat padded saddle, on over top of it and then headed out. And now the area out in Santa Rosa is very, rolly hills. Nothing too monstrous, but just lots of rolling hills. And in the morning, there was this fog that had laid in. So we're rolling through nice, cool air, rolling through these foggy hills, and I'm flying. And I remember at one point, you're not allowed to draft when you're cycling in a triathlon. It's right. a solo event.
Which means to ride behind somebody to make it easier.
Yep, on the exactly. windage. You tuck right. in behind their
if
wheel.
You're a NASCAR fan.
Exactly. It's exactly the same principle, only slower.
Yeah.
So you tuck in behind their wheel, and there's a tremendous advantage to being in someone's draft. So yeah. you have to be a minimum of, I think it's 2 or 3 bike lengths away from somebody. But nonetheless, you'd have these clutches of people that were riding in proximity to one another. And there was this little clutch of dudes that were in my age group, and we were flying. And I was a little bit uncomfortable with the speed we were going because I'm like, this is not sustainable.
Yeah.
And I remember
120 miles.
Yeah. So we're within the first 5-10 miles. And one of the guys in the group smartens up and he's like, hey, guys, we got to settle down. Settle down, boys. And I'm like, yeah, settle down. We got to settle down. So I peel off the pack and, you know, off this group and sort of settle into my own rhythm. And, you know, I'm going through the day and everything's going well. And I wasn't eating. And it was just a mistake I made. I wasn't eating. I was drinking lots of fluids and not eating enough food. And my gut got sour, which I think contributed to it. And by mile 90, I started having muscle cramps. And I had never experienced anything like this in my training so far. So it was a bit eye-opening. Ooh, I'm starting to have these little wiggles in my hamstrings and my hips are starting to get weird cramps. And so I slow down a little bit, finish the bike ride. I'm about 30 minutes behind my pace now.
What's the furthest that you had ridden before this 120?
So I had ridden several centuries, like a bunch of them. I probably did 4 or 5 centuries leading up to it. And then 30, 40, 60, 70 mile rides. Okay. So I was putting in very high mileage preparatory to this event.
But not with the 2.4 mile swim before it.
Right. Well, no, I did some bricks, but nothing quite that long. Okay. But again, I did not have a good nutrition plan. I went out too fast and I wasn't eating because of that. I didn't follow my own, I didn't stick to my own plan
yeah.
to stay the course. So I get off the bike, I'm about 30 minutes behind where I want to be. And I'm like, okay, we're good. I'm a runner.
Yeah.
Now we're in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Now remember, I'd never done a marathon before, so it's uncharted territory. So I start off, things are feeling pretty good. As I roll in, by the way, I forgot to mention this part. As I roll into the transition area, I swing my leg over the bike. And of course, as I come off the bike, my hamstring cramps wickedly. And I'm like, ooh, that's a problem. So I stretch out. I take my time in transition. There's a photo my wife has of me, which I don't know if I still have it, but I maybe. And I'm wearing my kit and I'm covered in salt. And I'm like, ooh, as I reflect back, you realize like that was a problem. I was imbalanced in my nutrition, mm-hmm. drinking tons of water, flushed my system out. All that salt was just on my body, not in my body.
Yeah.
So from a neurological perspective, muscularly, I was in a bad spot. So I head out on the marathon and I start off real slow, just trotting along, waiting for my legs to shake out so I could start running properly. And the first half of the marathon, went fairly well. I ran almost the entire way, right? With a few stops here and there to get nutrition as I go through the aid stations, et cetera. And I remember actually one aid station shocked me because I roll up and there's like cookies. And so I took like a giant stack of Oreos and I'm like, Oreos. And I'm like, this is what I need. So I'm popping Oreos as I'm trotting along and come in. This particular race course had loops. So I did one loop and then went back out for my second loop of the marathon. And at this point I'm losing time and I get out on the second half of the marathon And, you know, I had this objective in my mind. I'm like, you know what? I can do this in, I can get this done in 9 hours and 30 minutes. That was my completely naive expectation for what I could accomplish.
For the total race. Yep.
Just based on training speeds I had been able to ride and run. Like, yeah, I got this. No problem. Well, now I'm like, ooh, maybe 11 hours, right? I'm falling apart. And then I get in this back half of this marathon and I can no longer run. I'm having cramps in my legs and in my pelvis and in my abdomen, and places that I didn't know that had muscle fiber are cramping. And so I would trot a couple steps, everything would seize up, and I would stop, take a deep breath, and walk. And so now I'm basically walking, barely able to move. And so I'm like, okay, well, you know, was 9:20. Now I'm at like 11:30. I'm like, I might be able to finish before the cutoff, which is like 16 hours, right? I'm like, I'm struggling that bad. I'm hurting. At this point, the pain is beginning to set in, and I'm in pain. And a beautiful moment happened. I'm on the far backside of this marathon course, and I've got probably maybe 7-8 miles to go. And my wife, who was about 7 months pregnant at the time with our first kiddo, she comes out on the course. She was with my brother-in-law. And they drive out on this part of the course to cheer me on. And they see me coming. And last time they saw me, I was running. So I'm like, whoa, what had happened to this guy? So I'm barely moving. And she comes out and she starts walking with me. Now, she has this like green sundress on. And, it, you know, it's this beautiful little belly sticking out, right? Her big, you know, big 7 month pregnant belly. And she has this big sun hat. And she's walking with me. She's waddling. I'm waddling. we waddle together for a little ways, and she's like, "How are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm not doing good. I am really in pain. I am really hurting." And she's like, "Huh? Okay. Well, I'll see you at the finish line."
Yeah, your wife's like my wife.
And she left, and she gets in the car, and she drives away. And I got to tell you, at that moment, I had a bit of a crisis, right? Which was, I don't have a way out of here. I have to, and I said I would finish this event. And now my wife just said, "I'll see you at the finish line." I came out here to do something, and fucking, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So it might not be pretty. It will not be pretty at this point. It is not pretty at all. But I'm going.
Yeah.
And so I just keep trudging along. And as I came down the final stretch, there was a turn and about maybe 50 to 100 meters, I can't remember now exactly, of this hill that climbs up toward the finish line. And as I turn that corner, you got to remember in these ultra distance races, you wear a bib that has your number on it. And mine had my name, my last name. And this little lady who's sitting on the corner, she says, "All right, Gray, you're an Iron Man." And I turn the corner. And I'm heading up this rise toward the finish line, and I can see the arch, this, you know, inflated arch they have up there. And I see all these people, and they're cheering for their family members or their friends or whoever are coming. And I can spot the green sundress, and I see my wife, and I'm getting a little choked up because I haven't thought about this in a long time. But I remember my wife saying, "I'll see you at the finish line." Now, the reason I'm getting choked up is because everything that I've done in my life, I've had support. And I think about these moments in our lives where we have people who are there for us, who are present in our lives, who encourage us, who shore us up, who support us. And it is so important that we keep that in mind, right? That we are not alone, that we have people. We have our people. And all the, who cares about running an Ironman? It's a stupid thing, right? But everything I've done in my life, I've had somebody who is cheering me on. In high school, it's my mom. Oh, yeah. She was my biggest football fan, right? She wore if I played on one, and we had our home team jersey and our away jersey, my mom would always wear the opposite jersey, right? She was that kind of fan. She'd put the little thing on her face, the little, you know, paw print on her cheek or whatever. She was a big fan. And I got to tell you, one of my triathlons I did, my mom showed up, and I'm running through. Here I am, like 35 years old, right? I go running by. She goes, "There goes my baby." So I tell you that because when you think about the things that you're doing in your life, if you're, you know, like we'll talk about testing for the fire department, you have to think about the people who are supporting you. And in some of my interview processes, I told you there's, you know, some of my stories that I like to share. One of them is this story about the Iron Man, because the takeaway for me wasn't just, oh, hey, I went and did this thing, an event, I did an Iron Man. No, for me, it was about, it was planning and preparation. I trained for a year for a solitary moment, right? I mean, the moment took me 12 hours, but the, you know, it was this event, solitary event.
Yeah.
And so preparation and planning and then execution of the plan went into that. But I wasn't alone. My wife sacrificed as well during that journey, right? And then on game day, here I am. On game day, I had to put it all together, right? All the things that I did to prepare, tuning the bike up, getting my the right gear there, having my nutrition squared away. And I made some mistakes. Mm-hmm. And those mistakes cost me. And at some point, I'm in the pit of despair, physically pummeled. And guess what? I had more in me. And I thought, I'm like, oh man, this is, nothing could hurt worse. But guess what? You can still move forward. And then again, at that moment, who was there? Right? My partner in crime said, yeah. Hey, I got you. I'll see you at the finish line.
Yeah.
There's no quit in you. Right. You don't need to quit. What did you quit for? Keep moving. So showing up at the finish line. And the reason I got choked up is I think about all the different finish lines I've come to. Now, I've been married for 29 years. And every, you know, in that 29 years, how many finish lines have I arrived at? And I will tell you this, every finish line is just the beginning of the next adventure. So all these different things, these layers of things that we do in our lives are just moments that lead to the next moment. And we build on them. And it's important that we reflect on the things that we've done and reflect on these moments, because they strengthen us and they build our skill sets and our sets and reps that we talked about earlier, right?
Yeah.
All those sets and reps, these are part of it. They're all part of the fabric of your life that lead us into the next moment, the next event, the next testing process, the next promotion, the next challenge at work. All these things feed that. And we have to, and if you choose to ignore the shit storms and the things that have happened in your life, mm-hmm. well, then you're not going to grow. Because those are very, very important to who you are.
Yeah, I love that story. I told a story, I think, on your podcast. It sounds like our wives are very similar. I was in a weightlifting competition where you had to do a bunch of reps. I can't remember how many, but you had to do, I don't know, like 50 clean and jerks whatever at 100, and not heavy, but 135 pounds or something. But it adds up quick, you know. Mm-hmm. I took like a little break and like put my hands on my knees, and all the other wives are like yelling at their husbands, like, you're so strong, you're doing a great job. And I just hear my wife yell out, like, quit being a little bitch. You can rest when you're done. Uh-huh. So yeah, uh-huh. It's that support system. And then it's funny, you talked about like your wife sacrificed too for those accomplishments.
Right.
I remember when I got promoted to captain, at my pinning ceremony, I had my wife pin my captain's badge on me. I had my dad pin my firefighter badge when I got hired, and I had my wife pin my captain's badge. And, I gave like a little short speech, you know, and, I remember saying, you know, the wives should get badges too.
Right.
My wife needs a captain's badge too, because she sacrificed just as much as I did taking care of the kids and the house and supporting me. And, yeah, that person that's like, hey, I'll see you at the finish line, whether it's an Ironman or a testing process or whatever you're going through. It's important to have that,
yeah.
that person, whether it's your wife or your husband, your spouse or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, we always preach on the Instagram. I'll post pictures of us on date night. We go on date night once a week. And, I always tell them, you know, like, hey, pro tip, 'cause everybody following us was either a firefighter or wants to be one. And like, hey, pro tip, like never stop dating your spouse because one, they've earned it. And two, this is a job, and someday the job's going to be gone. And you know who's still going to be there?
Yeah.
Your wife.
Yeah. So let me tell you a story. We just took a trip, family trip to Spain, and we were talking about a little bit offline before. And the leading up to that trip, my wife's like, and this is something we've always wanted to do. And we've been planning and preparing, and COVID came to town. We were like ready to go, and COVID came a couple years ago and ruined everything. But we saw a window that this is going to work out. So, hey, we're going to take a trip to Spain. Well, that would require taking 3 weeks off of work. And I was like, oh, I don't know.
Phoenix Fire will stop running if I'm not there, honey.
She's like, the hell it will, right? It's been going long before I got there, and it's going to continue to go, right?
Yeah.
And so I went in, and I said, hey, to my counterpart at work, I said, hey, I need you to put this in my activity calendar. I need you to put this in the calendar for my telestaff. And she goes, oh, okay. And as she's putting it in, this wave of nausea comes over me. Now, this is ridiculous. I have like 500 hours of vacation hours that I had not used. Right? I got time.
Yeah.
But I just had this moment where I had to set priorities and realize that, hey, you got to set time apart. This is what this looks like. You've done all the things you need to do to set the shop up to be successful while you're gone. It will be fine.
Yeah.
And guess what? It was. They had a major CAD crash. They had telestaff crash. All kinds of crazy stuff went down. And guess what's still happening? The alarm room's running. Trucks are running. People are doing business. Those folks in that alarm room handle business.
Oh, yeah.
They are so good. And the last thing they need is me getting in the way. So, frankly, they were probably better off with me out of the country. But the beauty is what you're talking about is the prioritization of relationships, right? That relationship's going to be there long after the fire department, after you retire or whatever. You know, those people in your lives are really, really important, and you got to make sure that you set them as a priority. So I love that you guys go on day night. That's amazing.
Yeah, we do it every week. And, I mean, we may miss a day here and there. I'm not, you know, but pretty much every week and people are like, oh, we just don't have time for that. I'm like, you do, you're just not making the time. Right. I promise that you do. And it's funny not to try to wrap everything into firefighting, but before we went online too, we were talking about RBO, by objective with, at least here in Arizona, we have a really good relationship between our senior staff, our chiefs, and our labor group, our union, and they meet and make decisions together. And one of the main rules is we don't sacrifice relationships for objectives, or we don't sacrifice relationships for goals, or I can't remember the exact...
The way you said it's exactly right.
Yeah. And so it should be the same thing with your spouse, right? Hey, I have an objective. It's to complete an Ironman or get hired by the fire department or promote to captain or promote to deputy chief or whatever it is. And that's important to have her walking alongside you saying, I'll see you at the finish line, the support. Mm-hmm. But it's also important that you don't abuse that and say, I'm going to sacrifice my relationship for my objective. Right. So it's that balance, right? Mm-hmm. Have her walk beside you, but also take her on date night.
100%. 100%. It's not all about you, right?
Yeah.
Especially a marriage, but relationships are about balance and sacrifice for one another and empathy. And you have to be thinking about what the other person's, and I'm saying all this stuff like I'm really, really good at it. It's a practice, right?
Yeah.
It takes work.
We should get our wives in here. They'll be like, these guys are full of shit.
Yeah. That's a different podcast. But that's exactly, you know, the point you bring up is this the give and take of a relationship. It's, you have to feed back into it. It's not all about you. It's about the team, the collaboration with one another, and working together on stuff. And you know, I think of a time when it was sometime after medic school. I was having a conversation with somebody. I'm like, oh, some verapamil. It's like 5 milligrams or something. She goes, it's 2.5 and 5. And I was like, how do you know that? She's like, I studied all the same crap you did. Because she was essentially helping me through medic school, right?
I've been listening to you do these flashcards for months.
She was my study buddy. And poor thing. But yeah, she's, you know, part medic. Anyways, so right there alongside me the entire way.
Yeah. Yeah, we have talked before on your podcast about the dark place. And mostly not so much in relation to mental health, but more so in relation to physical fitness.
Yeah.
Whether it doesn't have to be an Ironman. It could be a much shorter workout. Like, me and my workout partner yesterday did the 1 minute Aerodyne thing. Have you done that? Oh, it freaking sucks.
Yeah.
So you get on the Aerodyne bike, you know, with the big fan, and you go for 1 minute as hard as you can.
That's a long time.
Full out, you know. And if you do this and you say it wasn't hard, it's because you didn't go 100%. Because one thing I always tell people about fitness is it doesn't get easier. You just get faster, right?
Right.
As far as the pain threshold,
from
day one to year 10, it sucks just as bad. You're just faster or stronger, or whatever your goal is.
Have you ever watched a pro cyclist?
Yeah.
And they're flying at 30 miles an hour like it's nothing.
Yeah.
The difference is they're just practiced at it. But they're running like the Tour de France is right. weeks long. They just suffer faster.
They're just suffering at a faster pace. They're suffering at a
faster pace, yeah. I sometimes would argue, though, I'm like, hey, the elite level Ironman finish in sub 8 hours. It's ridiculous how fast they go. It's gotten so fast. I like to think the folks at the back of the pack are the true heroes because they're going twice as long.
Yeah.
So they're really, you want to talk about who's the endurance athlete.
Oh, you only went 8 hours?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's weak.
Lame.
That's weak. You couldn't hold out for 16? Come on. That's weak. Yeah. It's amazing. I transitioned into ultra marathons and trail marathons, and it was really a function of training for Ironman took a lot of time. And you know, once we had kids, I'm like, I need to do like a single sport. I can't be doing all this. So I just focused on running and started doing trail ultras and stuff like that. And I remember getting passed by one of the elite level guys on this race course. And I stopped at an aid station. So in ultra marathons, they'll have tents set up and like food spreads and you know, water. And so you run for, you know, 7, 8, 9 miles and you run into this little tent, you fill up your water bottles, your camel pack, whatever, you grab a little bit of food and you head out. So I'm in there. Like, I'm like, oh, look, a buffet. So I'm like, cookies, chips, oh, you know, boiled potatoes with salt. I'm like, I'm eating all this food. And this elite level racer comes running through. We were on like a dog leg or something. He had gone out and was coming back. He was miles and miles ahead of me. Okay. We're talking hours ahead of me. And he comes blowing through this aid station, literally slams his hand in a bowl of chips. Takes whatever came out with him and was gone.
Yeah.
And I just see him throw this handful of chips in his mouth as he's blowing down the trail. And I was like, dude, that's a whole other level of capacity, like human capacity at that level. Freaking remarkable. It, really amazing.
Yeah. And now you're training for a mountain bike race, 24 hours old Pueblo.
Yeah. So along with all this endurance training is, I love mountain biking and and for years we did a team competition where we would do the 24 hours old Pueblo as a team. And part of, so I turned 50 this year and decided I was going to do a handful of things in my 50th year. And one of them was something, a dream of quite some time was to do old Pueblo as a solo competitor. So I'm going to go out there for 24 hours and ride as many miles as my little legs will take me.
Are you going to sleep?
I'm going to try not to. I might have to schedule a break in there at some point.
How long is the circle at Old Pueblo?
If I remember correctly, so it's been a while since I've been down there. I haven't done my research just recently, but I believe it's 16 miles.
Okay. And do you know what the elevation change is up and down?
I don't remember.
It's not terrible,
I choose to not know. Right? No, yeah, it's not. No, no, no. It's not horrible. Old Pueblo, of course, has some rollers in it and a couple of shorter steep climbs. And it's not super technical. It's all very rideable.
Okay.
There's some cactus gardens that are really narrow, and you got to be careful because if you fall off one side or the other, you're going to land in a bushel of cactus. And but it's very rideable. It's once you're in the, you know, once you're lap 5, lap 6, lap 7,
yeah.
You know, you're upwards of 70 miles, it starts to get hard.
What's your goal mileage for 24 hours?
My goal for this race is 100 miles. And I'm being conservative because this is a comeback for me. I have this background as an endurance athlete. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I had a tumor in my spine, and that took away my running, took away everything for a long period of time. And so coming back into the endurance athletics, this is my kind of first foray back into endurance sports. So
I love it.
Yeah.
And 100 miles, we're not talking about a road bike where you're flying. This is a mountain bike off road. So 100 miles on a mountain bike would be quite the feat. I really want to do Old Pueblo, but I learned that you have to sign up like in the first 1 second that it's open.
Yeah, it feels super fast.
Right away.
Yeah.
But I want to get down there. I want to do that.
You should come down to the race and at least hang out.
I'll come down there and hang out.
Yeah.
I'll freaking get some Oreos for you.
There you go. You're my Oreo runner.
So if I'm not signed up, can I still come hang out at your camp for a little bit?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So I've got a couple of cats that are going to come down and be my base camp manager. Okay. We already have an agreement that they won't let me sit down, and he just keep riding. And what we do is we'll have our tent will be right on the race course. So you come, the way they do this, they have a control tent where you go in, they count your lap, and then you head back out. Normally, if you're racing with a team, you would switch a baton at that point. So it's a transition tent. You come in, the transition, the next rider goes out, and you go back to your camp.
And is it a four-man team usually?
They have a different variety, but there's four-man, there's five-man, and there's corporate, which can be up to 10.
Okay.
And so we've done every combination of that over the years. And it's a lot of fun, actually. You take a bunch of firemen down there and do a corporate with like 7-8 people, so everyone gets like 2 or 3 laps in. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. So the you go into that transition tent. For the solo riders, you go through that transition tent. They count your lap, and then you go back out. So what most folks will do is they'll get a camp that's right along the side of the trail, and so they'll go around their lap, and they'll pull into their camp, adjust their bottles, adjust their gear, change batteries for their headlights, whatever, and then they go down, go through the transition tent, and keep riding.
Half of this is going to be at night.
Oh, yeah.
And then this is a pretty laid-back event. I have some friends
that have done
it. It's a tell us about the tequila tree.
I don't know about the tequila tree.
You haven't heard about that yet?
Listen, I'm a serious athlete, bro. I'm not out there screwing around.
I heard that there. So my buddy Chad Laswell, he's a pretty serious rider, and so he jokes around like, if we go out mountain biking, he's the one that like wears his like specialized skin tight gear, you know, and the rest of us are in shorts or whatever. And so he's very serious, and he's done the 24 hours at Old Pueblo, and he said there's this. Maybe it's just the 1 year he went, there was this thing called the tequila tree, where these guys want you to pull over and do a shot the middle of your lap.
Okay.
And if you don't pull over, the crowd that's there boos you.
That's funny. I've never actually experienced that, but it does not surprise me. So the beauty of the 24 Hours of Pueblo is that it has a cult following, right? These 24 hour races have a cult following that has very much the serious, very competitive, ultra elite athletes. And then you have the rest of us who are just out there to have a good time. Yeah. And they have a legit good time.
I heard it's quite the party.
Yeah. There's folks that dress up in costumes and their teams do a whole thing and they're just out there to have a good time. And then there's the solo competitors who some are very, very elite and are out there just flying around the course for 24 hours. And then, the rest of those folks are just out there to do what they can and have a good time and push themselves to their personal goals and personal objectives. And they're just as serious an athlete, just not at the same competitive level. It's really cool. It's a very, very cool event.
I got to get signed up for that. You got to send me a heads up when you're getting ready to sign up.
Cool.
So I can go.
For sure.
I want to do it for sure. And I just got my wife into mountain biking. I just bought her a full suspension last month.
Nice.
Shaved 9 minutes off her lap time just by switching bikes.
Nice.
Yeah. It's really fun.
The bike matters.
Okay. I got some questions from Instagram that we have to answer. So I asked people what they wanted to ask you. So let's hit up a couple of these questions.
Let's do it.
So one of them, and I can't remember the last name. Or who asked it, because it got deleted off my Instagram. But a play on your name, right? He wants to know, would you rather be Rain Man or Rain, whatever his last name is, who plays Dwight Schrute?
Oh, is it Rain Wilson?
Rain Wilson, that's it. Would you rather be...
Are we talking Rain Man the movie?
I'm assuming that's all he said. I don't have any back information.
Okay, so I will tell you this. So my name... since we're going there, has been the bane of my existence. Right? Well, as a little kid, I was tortured relentlessly, as little kids do, because I lived in Vancouver, if you remember, which is very rainy and wet, which I think inspired my parents, who were hippies. So this is a hippie, the product of a couple of hippie parents who thought I was going to be an actor, not a firefighter. And so
it is a cool name.
Thank you. So
Rain Gray.
So as a kid, it was things like rain, rain, go away. Come again. So, raindrops keep falling on my head. I'm like, okay. So, I will tell you, as a kid, I always wanted a nickname. I always wanted something different, but honestly, Rain was a really cool name. And by the time I got to high school, it changed and people are like, oh, that's a cool name. And I'm like, oh, wow, all right, cool.
Yeah,
I guess it is a cool name. So I've enjoyed it. So, yeah. So no, I don't want either one of those. Thank you.
You'd be Rain Gray. That would have been, I was actually thinking about that when I saw the question. I hope he goes, I choose Rain Gray. Boosted Dash wants to know how do fire vets fare in the fire service versus those who have not served?
So I honestly believe that veterans do really, really well in the fire service. There's a certain amount of structure. The paramilitary nature of the organization absolutely plays into the organizational structure, and that is something that folks that are military veterans have an acquaintance to and they do really well with. Me personally, it was kind of funny when I first came in. I expected it to be a lot more dress, for lack of a better expression.
Yeah.
I expected it to be a little tighter, shinier boots, you know, and honestly, in some parts of the country, the fire service is that way.
California, I've heard.
Yep.
And even here in Arizona, I've heard Tucson.
Tucson's pretty tight. Exactly. Yeah. So again, we talked earlier about kind of understanding the organization that you're going into. And I think that's a part of what you look at is, does the culture of this organization match my expectations and my desires in my career? But generally speaking, vets do really, really well because of some of the stuff that we just talked about.
Nate Morgan wants to know, how do you motivate yourself to frequently work out?
It's about priority and having a desire for a certain outcome is simply put. There are days when I wake up and I don't want to work out. And there's been times in my life when I haven't, when I fall into that trap and I didn't, and I had to say to myself, okay, what do you really want out of your life?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you'll see my Instagram and stuff. I post videos on there where I'm just trying to get my shit together.
Yeah. Right?
Just like everybody. And so for me, I look now and this has changed over the years, right? When I was younger, it was, I want to go do this crazy event. And so I would set it on the calendar. Okay. You're going to go run 100-mile race. You have a need, a priority every day when you wake up to be prepared for that event. Because if you're not prepared, you're going to suffer big time. So for me, setting goals, that really helped a lot for me to have priorities of working out every single day. Then it became, when I got on the job, it was, hey, there's an expectation that when I show up to work, I have a certain capacity to perform. And so what am I going to do today to be able to provide the service that's required tomorrow? And so for me, that was enough, right? I come to work, I'm going to be lifting, I'm going to be running, I'm going to be training, working my cardio, working my strength, working my power, because there's an expectation that not only does the customer have a need potentially for rescue, but what about the guy on my truck?
Yeah.
You know, my partners, I have, you know, one of my most important expectations is that I'm capable of helping you if something goes sideways. So that has driven me to get in the gym more often than anything else. And as I've gotten older and, I'm not on a fire truck anymore, you could argue that my fitness doesn't really matter. But at this point, it's, I want longevity in my health and in my career. And I want to be able to crawl around on the ground with my grandkids someday.
Yeah.
Right. Should I have any? I don't have any yet, but someday I will. And so I want to be able to be there and go play and do fun stuff with them. So I think it's about identifying the most important thing I would say to summarize it all is identify what's important to you and what your priorities are. The training and exercise, the motivation comes as a result of setting purpose in your life. So you establish the purpose, the motivation follows.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think another important thing you said in there is to set a goal. So, and I like whatever you're motivated by. So if it needs to be financial, then go pay the $500 or whatever, sign up for Ironman, and you have 1 year to do it, or you wasted that money.
You've committed,
and you have a date, right? I've told people that before too. I go, it doesn't have to be an Ironman. Go sign up for a local CrossFit competition. Go sign up for 24 Hours at Old Pueblo. Go sign up for whatever, so that now you have a tangible date to say, okay, in 90 days, this is happening and I'm either going to be prepared or I'm not, versus like, well, I'm just going to kind of start dieting. And then things have to be with purpose. They have to be purposeful. So like right now I'm weighing all of my food for macros, and yes, it's a pain in the ass, but you have to be purposeful. You know, otherwise if I don't plan ahead, if I don't meal prep, I for sure will end up at Chick-fil-A 104% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's see what else we got in here. IGriff864 wants to know what your favorite snack is.
I don't even know anymore. I'm a big fan of like chocolate chip cookies. I like ice cream too, though.
Is it?
I don't know.
Poor Brothers chips. Is that the factory
we had to fire? We didn't talk about that, huh? Yeah, Poor Brothers. Yeah, no, I am a sweets guy. I love candy and sugar and it's a problem.
I know. Yeah. I do too. I can't have any of that right now.
Yeah.
I want to have like a reintroduction to being shredded. I'm not old enough to be. I've been spending too much time talking about how badass I used to be, and I'm not old enough to do that. So it's time to lock it back in.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate the question. But man, I there's too many. I am too much. I eat too many garbage foods to be able to like, what's my favorite snack? I don't have a favorite. It's all good. It's all good. I like it all. It's a problem.
NZen10 wants to know if you have any tips on interviews.
Yeah. So, gosh, where do you begin? This is what the whole platform is about. The know your story and why. Understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish. Why do you want to be a firefighter? Okay, a couple things. Let me break this down for a second. Why do you want to be a firefighter? First of all, you have to understand your reason for wanting to do this job. Partly because this job is dangerous. It will leave an emotional and physical scar on you. And so you have to be willing and understand why you are getting yourself involved in that type of career path. It is an absolutely noble and amazing place to make a career. But if you are not ready for some of the impacts it's going to have on your body and on your mind, then it's not going to be worth it. The other thing is you have to build the toolbox. So you have to think about the things that have happened in your life that shape who you are and how those things connect to what you're doing in the fire service. So much like I shared the story about Iron Man, there's elements in that story that as I reflected on, I'm like, oh, these are things that are important to me and shape my life and shape who I am in the things that I'm doing. There's other things that have happened that we didn't talk about, but when you think about your life, those elements shape who you are and what you bring to the table. So if you start talking about how, oh, I'm all about customer service, I believe in customer service, well, share an example of mm-hmm. what that really means and how you actually operationalize that in real life and how you will operationalize it in the fire service. So if you can't articulate those things, then you're not going to be really prepared for an interview. So
perfect.
There's a couple of things.
Yeah, that's basically exactly what we teach. If anybody listening doesn't know, we have a book called Fire Interview, The Storyteller Method. And so I was glad to hear you say, like, what's your story? Give me an example. Tell me a story. Don't just tell me I'm good at customer service. Great. Tell me the story.
Well, let me just add one thing. I've sat on interview boards many, many times. And the interviews that stand apart are the people who share a piece of themselves.
Yeah.
Hey, you asked me a question. And we'll just use customer service because we just talked about it. But you asked me a question about customer service. Well, let me tell you why it's really important as a customer, as a person who's provided service into other customers. Like, why is it important, really?
Yeah.
But so many people come in there and they give this rote answer that everybody gives.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, customer service is important. It's important to the organizations for their reputation and blah, 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 blah. You got to differentiate yourself. Tell me a little bit about you. You're the commodity that's being assessed.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Last question. JSNUAZ. I'm not sure what that's supposed to stand for, but that's who asked it.
These Instagram handles get weirder and weirder.
I know. It's like trying to read license plates sometimes. I'm like, I don't know what that means. He wants to know why you're such a badass.
Well, can we just all agree that I'm not? Like, I'm not a badass.
You want me to answer it for you? I'll tell you why he's a badass. It's about consistency, right? You have short-term successes. You have long-term successes. So short-term success is like you bought a house, you got hired by the fire department, you finished TRT school. Those are all short-term successes. And then you build up short-term successes over a long period of time. And that becomes long-term success. So then you have 50-year-old deputy chief, Rain Gray, Iron Man athlete, blah, 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 Marine, all the other things that you've done. Well, now you can stamp it and say, now it's long-term success. And that comes from consistency. And to go back to the other guy's question, like, how do you keep working out? How are you going to do 100 miles at Old Pueblo? You're 50 years old. You're not an Ironman anymore. You know why? Consistency. Because you've been smoking a bottle in that stairwell, you know, in your turnouts every Monday for your whole career, consistently. That's why at 50 years old, Chief Gray is going to ride 100 miles.
Wow. You guys can't see this, but I'm over here blushing. Thank you. Thank you for your kind.
Yeah, I'll take that.
I appreciate
it. I'll take that 100 bucks after we get off here. So, well, thank you so much for coming. I'm sure we'll have you on here again because I have a list of things that we didn't get into.
But, I know there's so many things that we would love to share and talk about. And yeah, for sure. I'd love to come back.
Yeah. I want to talk. Because I want to do an Ironman, so I need to get some
training. You got to get into the deets. Yeah, sure. I got the advice. I know what not to do, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. And before I forget, where can they listen to your podcast? If you want to listen to a real podcast, get off of this one.
So my podcast is the Fireground Fitness Podcast. And it can be found at, you know, any platform that you enjoy listening to podcasts. It's available. And or you can go to firegroundfitness.com, which is just a blog spot that I set up a long time ago that has the podcast listed on it. It also has an archive of training program that I started back in 2007 for firefighters. It's a fantastic little program, I think. And it's just years and years and years of daily training workout sessions that we put together to give you something to train on and diversify your workouts. That's all free content that's available to you if you go there. You can find me at Fireground Fitness on Instagram or Facebook, and or Rain Gray Actual is also on there. And that's just my personal Instagram. Reach out to me at any point if you have a question, comment. If you have any words of wit, I would love to hear them. So,
yeah, definitely. I've been on his podcast. Did we figure out what episode
was? Episode 53.
Yeah, go listen to the Fireground Fitness Podcast, episode 53 with Captain Brendan Traynor. So, he's got a ton of great guests on there. So make sure you guys go and check that out. Chief, thanks so much for coming.
Hey, thank you for having me. And I want to say that I really enjoy what you're doing and appreciate what you're doing for the fire service, because there's so many quality candidates out there who just don't know what to do next. And, you know, the book that you put together, I read it and we talked about it on the podcast, and the work that you're doing to help folks be prepared to coming in is amazing, because there's so many good candidates out there. They just need to know what to do to kind of unlock their own potential. So thanks for providing some tools and some access for that.
Yeah.
And thanks for having me on. It's great. Love talking to you.
It's great. Both just trying to help people out, right? Yeah, exactly.